You might turn your Bibles to 2 Kings 9. Kings chapter 9, and we have been talking about the work of Jehu and disposing the northern kingdom of the Ahab regime. And, you know, I think that there's a couple of things we might say about Jehu. He has obviously been used by God as his instrument for judgment, and yet I think we ought to be careful and maybe even hesitant to attribute everything that Jehu does to God's purposes. I think the same would be the case of a Babylon or of Assyria that would come in and be used as a judgment force. What we see is, and really, you know, you think about Jeroboam, his house is destroyed by Baasha. Baasha is wicked. His house is destroyed. The rule of Zimri is taken out by Omri. Omri is just about as wicked as they come. Ahab's rule is wicked, and Jehu's going to come in and take and wipe that out. And that doesn't mean that there's any validation or support of the wickedness that these people are doing. It's merely God using these instruments for his purposes and judgment. In Hosea chapter 1 and verse 4, the prophet Hosea says, "The Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel, and on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." And so Hosea looks at what Jehu does and says that he stands to be condemned for some of it. And I think that's an interesting idea. But you know, Babylon would stand to be condemned for what they did to God's people, because they, for their own purposes and out of their own mouths, would come in and abuse God's people. God uses it for a judgment on his people. He uses it for a discipline for them. And yet they would stand to be done that. I think we'll also see some things where Jehu goes further than what God intended for him to go. And perhaps that's what Hosea is pointing to in Hosea chapter 1. So we come to the end of chapter 9 of 2 Kings. And it is not beyond Jehu's responsibility to take care of Ahab and Jezebel, because they are the ones who God has specifically ordained Jehu to be the ones to take care of. And so Jehu comes to Jezreel, and even though Samaria is the capital of Israel, Ahab and Jezebel seem to spend a lot of time at Jezreel, and maybe it becomes in some ways kind of a summer home or something like that for them. And they spend a lot of time there. And so that's where Jehu comes. And when Jezebel hears that Jehu is coming, what does Jezebel do? She fixes herself up. I think the idea is she wants to look like, and she's going. She anticipates, I think, that Jehu is coming to kill her, and so she's going to go out like she lived, and she's going to go out looking like a queen. I think is the idea. That is not how it goes for her. She does not go out looking very queenly, and we'll look at that in a moment. But I think the idea. Some have suggested that what she's going to do is she's going to seduce Jehu and keep him from killing her. I don't think that's the intention. Mostly because of the way she initially addresses Jehu doesn't seem to be very enticing anyway. And so she says, "Is it peace, you Zimri, murderer of your master?" Now Zimri was a usurper, right? He had taken over. Let's see, back in 2 Kings chapter. Let's see, where are we? Back in 1 Kings, right? 1 Kings 16, right? And he killed Elah, and then Zimri takes over after Elah. The thing about Zimri is, anybody remember how long he reigns? Yeah, a week. Yeah, so. And so the idea, I think, of Jezebel's question is, in calling him a Zimri, he may be overthrowing his master's house, but it's going to be short-lived. It's an insult. It's a, you think you're going to take the throne and control it, but you're just like Zimri. You'll be out of here before you know. That's not how it goes. Jehu ends up having at least a short dynasty in Israel, but Jezebel is trying to insult him, I think. And so Jehu looks up and says, "Hey, who's on my side?" And some units pop their head out and say, "Hey, we're here." And he says, "Throw her down." And so they threw her down. Evidently, word travels fast. Everybody knows that Jehu has wiped out Ahab and at least Azariah. And now he's got the army behind him. And so now they are on her side, and they throw her down. Now, there's some pretty vivid and description of blood splattered on the wall, and on the horses, and they trample on her. And then, they win a supper. Whew, man, yeah. I guess if you being a warrior, he'd sing some stuff, because that would be tough to eat supper after. He just goes and eats, and then at some point, during dinner, says, "Just go make sure she's buried." And when they went to find her, they didn't find anything but a skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. And when they came back and told him what happened, he said, "Oh yeah, the Lord did prophesy that about her, that in the territory of Jezreel, the dog shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be done on the face of the field in the territory of Jezebel, so that no one will say, this is Jezebel." She would be unidentifiable at the end of it. Well, you know, there might be some things we could say about the judgment of Jezebel. It is right to be joyful in one sense when wickedness is stopped. It is also right to be saddened at the path that a person chose to take. And I think both of those reactions are biblical reactions. So you have sadness in some ways, that God said, "I have no delight in the death of the wicked." And then, on the other hand, the only time in the New Testament where the word hallelujah is used, which we think of as a very praising word, the only time the word hallelujah is used is when Babylon is destroyed in Revelation 19. You have those souls beneath the altar in Revelation 6 crying out, "How long?" You have the psalmist praying for God's judgment on the wicked. And so I think there is a right response of sadness and maybe whatever else it might be when somebody goes down that path, and even when we see their end, because we know what that end means, whether we know it's not the end, we know there's something even beyond that. But there is also a
vindication when someone who has oppressed God's people is judged. If it's God's will, if it's something that God ordains, if it's God's purpose, then God's people can find something to praise Him for in that. And I think we see that in Jezebel, in the elimination of this woman who had done so much to harm and hurt the people of God. Not just in leading them astray, but even in persecuting and killing those who would remain faithful.
Because
we
know God is just.
Do what? Because we know God is just. Yes, we know God is just. Now, we're talking about this on Sunday. It is less easy for us to... It is very easy, less appropriate, for us to speak with joy at the demise of our enemies. Because our enemies might not be the same as God's enemies. I think it is appropriate when someone who is God's enemy. And maybe we have less perspective than we have when we look. When we look at the scriptures, we know who's on the right side and who's on the wrong side. It might be harder for us, but there are times where we can tell. There are times where we know. And in those times, we can both be saddened at the demise, but understand that justice will be done, and that there's a right attitude of praise when that happens.
Okay. One thing that we should get out of, even though it was tragic that this actually happened to her, but she put herself in that position. The thing that we should get out of it is when God tells you something is going to happen, that it's fulfilled. Just like today, He tells us that Christ is going to come back sometime. That we should be prepared at any time to meet Him, whether we die or He actually comes back to earth.
That's right.
But everybody's going to be judged for the deeds that they've done. And this is a prime example. He judged Jezebel for the deeds that she done.
Yeah, there's a sense in which if this life is all there is, some people get off the hook for heinous things. And some people spend their whole life oppressed, even though they have tried to serve God. But what we have in the judgment when Jesus comes, all that's going to be taken care of. Everything's going to be put right. And God's going to do it exactly the way it's supposed to be done. And so we can find comfort in God's justice. If we're searching for ultimate justice here, right, that we're going to get all the wrongs righted and all the remuneration paid and all that, we're going to wait a long time for all that's taken care of. But what we can look forward to is the judgment when everything will be set right. That's a good point. Okay, so in chapter 10, Jehu is continuing his work of cleaning out Israel of Ahab and Baal influence. And so Ahab has 70 sons in Samaria. I assume not all by Israel. And so sometimes I have made the assumption, for example, that like Athaliah was Jezebel's daughter. She seemed to have a lot of Jezebel in her. She was maybe influenced by Jezebel, whether she was Jezebel's blood daughter or not. But nonetheless, he has lots of children. And as the king, he must have had access to lots of women. And so that's what happens. But all of these, Jehu views, I think, as threats to the throne. And maybe he doesn't view them necessarily as threats to the throne, but this is part of his work in taking care of Ahab's influence. And I'm not sure that it's beyond what God would have called him to do in order to do it. And so he writes to the elders of the city of Samaria, which again I may mention is the capital city of Israel. It makes sense that Ahab's sons would be there in the capital city. And when they see this, they are to select the master, the sons of Ahab are to take their best fighter and say, and meet Jehu out for battle. Champion versus champion. And they probably heard what happened to Jehoram and to Ahaziah. And they know that Jehu is a capable fighter. And they said, we don't have anybody to stand up against. And they said at the end of verse 5, we're your servants. We'll do all that you tell us. We will make anyone can do whatever is good in your eyes. The idea is we are completely giving our allegiance to you. We won't even put up a competitor against you. And he said, well, this is to the elders of the city of Samaria. He said, if you really are on my side, take all those sons they have, who they were responsible for rearing and bringing up. They've been put into their charge as guardians. He says, you take all of them and you send me their heads in baskets. And notice in verse 8, when the messenger came and told them, they had brought the heads of the king's sons. I mean, pretty just matter of fact. The heads you order here, like Amazon Prime. And laid them in two heaps at the entrance of the gates of the morning. And this would indicate to everybody in Jezreel that Jesus is in charge. There's no question about that. The revolt is over and Jesus is in charge. And notice this in verse 9. He went up and stood out and said to all the people, you are innocent. It was I who conspired against my master and killed him. But who struck down all these? I think Jehu's point in that is to say, this is not just a one-man operation of one guy who's frustrated they have. Obviously, there are a lot of people who are on my side, or else I wouldn't have all these heads sitting in my front door. And so I think what he's trying to do with that is build support and say, look, if I didn't have support across the country, if I didn't have support in Samaria, the capital, these heads would not have been delivered to. But the fact that they have means he's in power and has influence. And so in verse 10, Jehu, I don't think is a model character in any sense, but he's right here in verse 10. Know then that there shall fall the earth nothing of the word of the Lord. That's what Mr. Stephen said. Nothing that God has spoken is going to fall by the wayside unfulfilled. Everything that God said would come through Jehu is coming through. It's coming true through Jehu. Which, and notice this, which the Lord spoke during the house of Ahab, for the Lord has done what he said by his servant Elijah. Elijah had anointed Elisha. Elisha had sent the servant to anoint Jehu. Now Jehu has accomplished the work that God gave Elijah to do in order to judge the house of Ahab. That work is accomplished. And he struck down all the remains of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, all the brethren, his close friends, his priests, and he left him none remaining. It's a thorough cleansing of the house of Ahab. You see this in verse 12. They set out and went to Samaria on the way. He was at that ethic of the shepherds. Jehu met relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah. And he said, who are you? And they answered, we are the relatives of Ahaziah. We came down to visit the royal princes and the sons of the queen mother. He said, take them alive. And they took them alive and slaughtered them at the pit of that ethic, 42 persons, and he spared none of them. I wonder if this might not be what Hosea is talking about when he talks about the blood being required of Jehu because of what he did at Jezreel. And the reason I say that is because the writer here in Kings is very clear to indicate that these are relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah. Now, Ahaziah is obviously tied into the family of Ahab. And so maybe Jehu thinks that this is what he needs to be doing because they may be tainted with Ahab influence. But these are not Israelite royals. These are Jewish royalty. And so when he does that there, maybe it's perhaps this. I think it could be that this is what Hosea points back to and says, this is where Jehu went too far. And maybe before that, I don't know. But then he leaves there, and Jehu finds Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. Now, you'll remember the Rechabites. They are mentioned over in Jeremiah chapter 35, verses 6 and 7. It's kind of an obscure place, but the Rechabites are commended by Jeremiah. Not because they were necessarily completely faithful to everything that God had delivered, but they were faithful to what their father, who's mentioned right here, Jehonadab, had mentioned. And Jehonadab had told them to drink no wine and to not build houses or sow seed, live in tents. You may live in days and sojourn. And notice verse 8, he says, we have obeyed the voice, this is Jeremiah 35, verse 8, we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, and all that he commanded us, to drink no wine all our days, ourselves, our wives, our sons, our daughters, and not to go to houses to dwell in. We have no vineyard or field or sea, but we have lived in the tent and obeyed and done all that Jonadab, our father, commanded us. I think the point that Jeremiah is making in Jeremiah chapter 35 is that if the Rechabites would have that level of devotion to their forefather Jonadab, shouldn't the people of Judah have had much greater devotion to what God had told them to do? And so in one sense, the Rechabites listening so carefully to their forefather Jonadab was a condemnation of the fact that Judah was so willing to dispense with what their fathers had taught, with what God had taught. They just threw that away. And here's a human, Jonadab, tell Judah said it's going to do, and they cling to it like it's the gospel. And Judah has the actual commandments of God. And they just dismiss it that it's nothing. And so Jonadab, I think, is probably someone who is concerned about doing right. And he is concerned about his descendants' faithfulness. And I think even faithfulness to the Lord. Now, they're not Jews. And so maybe they don't have all the same requirements that you do. But notice that in verse 15, when he departed there, he met Jonadab, he's going to read that coming to him. And he greeted him and said, "Is your heart true to my heart, as mine is to yours?" And Jonadab answered, "It is." He said, "If it is, give me your chariot, give me your hand." So he gave his hand, and he took him up into his chariot, and he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord." So he had him ride in his chariot. Now, I don't know, again, exactly what Jehu's attitude here is, but it always makes you suspicious when somebody says, "Hey, come see how zealous I am for the Lord." It always makes you wonder exactly where the emphasis is. Is it on the zeal for the Lord or seeing the zeal for the Lord? And with Jehu, he wants Jonadab. Evidently, he thinks that his own fervor for God's cause will appeal to Jonadab. And he wants Jonadab to be his ally in this. And so he says, "Hey, come see how zealous I am for the Lord." And he's going to show it. Anything through verse 17 before we get... I know I'm moving quickly, but maybe it's all making sense and time to go. Okay, so verse 18, Jehu is going to take care of the prophets of Baal. Now, he starts out saying that if Ahab served Baal a little, how's Jehu going to serve it? Much, all right? So he kind of puts out this propaganda that Ahab, he was a lightweight when it came to serving Baal. Jehu's going to really show you how it's done. And so he calls for this great festival of Baal, and he says all the priests of Baal need to be there under the threat of death, right? You'll get killed if you don't come to this feast for Baal. And so, of course, all the priests of Baal, they don't want to be killed, and so they show up. And then, this is in verse 22, he said to him, verse 23, "Then Jehu went to the house of Baal with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, and he said to the worshippers of Baal, 'Search and see that there is no servant of the Lord here among you, but only the worshippers of Baal.'" I don't want any Yahweh worshippers here. I want you to get them out. You make sure that only Baal worshippers are. So they come back and they say, "Yep, we're just Baal worshippers." And Jehu stationed 80 men outside and said, "The man who allows any of those who might get into your hands to escape shall forfeit his life. You kill them or you'll be killed." And so instead of you being killed if you don't show up, the Baal priests are killed because they do show up. And Jehu takes care of them, strikes them down, doesn't let them escape. And this is in verse 26. "They brought out the pillar that was in the house of Baal and burned it, and they demolished the pillar of Baal, demolished the house of Baal, and made a latrine to this day." So, if we were to stop right here with Jehu, we would say, well, he's been pretty vicious. And maybe he goes too far in taking out some of the relatives of Ahaziah, the king of Judah. But so far, we would say he has been zealous for what the Lord gave him to do. He has been zealous for taking care of Ahab. He's been zealous for getting rid of Baal worship. In verse 28, "Thus Jehu wiped out Baal from Israel." Well, that's a pretty good thing to do. Baal worship was a blight on Israel's history. But notice verse 29. "But Jehu did not turn aside from the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel a sin. That is, the golden calves that were in Bethel and Dan." When Jehu said, "Come and see my zeal for the Lord," it's interesting that his zeal for the Lord seemed to have its limit, didn't it? And his zeal for the Lord only went as far as Jehu's personal interests. You see, Baal worshippers were connected to the house of Ahab and Jezebel. Baal worshippers would have been supporters and advocates for Ahab and Jezebel. And so, as such, they would have been threats to Jehu's reign. And so he wants to make sure they're taken out. Now, they also happen to be wicked, vile people who don't obey God. And so, Jehu's purposes and God's purposes, they go a long way together, don't they? But then, when Jehu's purposes and God's purposes don't match, Jehu does not say, But I'm zealous for the Lord, so I'm going to be obedient. He just stops. He just doesn't do what God told him to do. And I think that's the condemnation of Gideon, that what happens is that the removal of the Baal prophets looks to be just political opportunism. Taking out Baal is a benefit to his regime, and so he'll do it. But when there's something that's not a benefit to his regime, he doesn't do it. So his purpose in this is self-promotion, not faithfulness to the Lord. His purpose in this is just to get what he can out of it. And so he leaves the golden calf worship that Jeroboam is doing. Now, is that better? Is it better to get rid of Baal worshipers? Yeah. But it's not faithfulness. You know, the worship of Baal was awful, wicked, abominable stuff. But just because you've gotten rid of Baal doesn't make you faithful to Yahweh. And I think that's important for us to remember. Just because you get rid of some bad stuff doesn't make us faithful to the Lord. There are things I really like Lydia, and I would be faithful for Lydia, even if the Lord didn't require it. You know, God tells me to be faithful to one woman for the rest of my life, I'm okay with it. You know, but what happens when God tells me to do something that I don't particularly want to do? Am I willing to do that too, or am I only going to obey God in the things that I enjoy obeying? Maybe it's something else for you that. Here's something that you enjoyed it. I enjoy singing. When God commands us to sing, not a problem for me. Right? Now, the contributing part, you know, it's a little tough, you know. But am I just going to say, well, I like the singing part, so I'll come sing my zeal for the Lord. Come listen to me. And then, when it comes to the contributing, then I would just leave that aside. Those are things I think we can consider from this. And we can also consider a couple of things, that just because he who serves God's purpose in removing Ahab doesn't make him righteous. So sometimes the Bible reports things about that. Anything that you'd like to say through about, I don't know, verse 29?
Wasn't Ahaziah the grandson of Ahab?
That's right. So
that's and, the reason he killed him, not his brothers.
Yes. That's right. He was.
Killed his brothers.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because the Bible often kind of ties Ahaziah more to the southern king. To Jehoram, but Jehoram was influenced by Athaliah. She had directed him in doing evil, and Jehoram was punished for that, and she introduced Baal worship through him. And then Ahaziah, remember we're talking about in 2 Chronicles 21, that his 22, his mother counseled him to do evil. She gave him advice in doing wickedness. And so she, Judah, this is an interesting point. Israel and Judah are pretty closely aligned right now. Think about the fact we've got Jehoram, and Ahaziah. There are not two other kings, there's not another king named Jehoram, and there's not another king named Ahaziah during the whole period of Israel and Judah. So we say these are such common names, and there's not another king named those in the entire reign of Israel and Judah. Now I think what's being indicated by that is that's how close these families are. They're naming each other after each other, right? Judah is really being named after people in Israel. And that shows how closely connected all of these folks are. And that's a serious problem. And not only is Israel being influenced by Ahab, but even the line of David is being influenced by Ahab. Okay, now in verse 30, the Lord said to Gideon, because you have done well to carry out what is right in my eyes, and have done the house of Ahab according to all that is in my heart, your sons to the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. So Gideon accomplishes his purpose in judging Ahab's house, and God commends him for that, and gives him a dynasty to the fourth generation. But, verse 31, Gideon was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not turn from the sins of Jeroboam, which made Israel sin. And so, verse 32, in those days, the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel. He's going to take away territory from Israel. He's made a promise to Jehu that he's going to have a dynasty to the fourth generation. But that doesn't mean that Jehu is not going to suffer the consequences of his own sin, even during his own lifetime. And so you see all the territory that Hazael again, he's going to show up again. This is God's instrument in Syria being used to judge Jehu. You see that? Jehu is used to judge Ahab. Hazael is going to be used to judge Jehu. And later on, Hazael to chastise Joash or Jehoash in chapter 12. Okay, Judah reigns 28 years, and he died. Anything you'd like to say from chapter 10 about all of that? Okay, I want you to look with me at a passage in 2 Samuel 7. This is a familiar passage we've looked at several times, but I want to refresh our minds now. 2 Samuel 7, and this is the promise that God makes to David, beginning at verse 16. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. This is how the psalmist said in Psalm 89 and verse 36. His offspring shall endure forever, his throne as long as the sun before him. God makes a promise to David and says his throne is going to last forever. His son is going to reign forever. Well, we come to 2 Kings chapter 11. And I want you to keep something in mind. Athaliah married Jehoram. Do you remember what Jehoram did to all his brothers? He killed them all and he took the throne. Alright? And then you've got all of Ahaziah's brothers have been carried off by the Philistines and by the Arabs. And now, notice what Athaliah does. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal family, the whole royal seed. But, except, Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from the king's sons who were being put to death, and she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Thus they hid him from Athaliah so that he was not put to death, and he remained with her 6 years, hidden in the house of the Lord, while Athaliah reigned over the land. So the only time that a usurper replaces the Davidic line on the throne in Jerusalem is right here. And it's clear to me that the king's narrator does not think of Athaliah as a legitimate occupant of the throne. Because in every other case when a king takes the throne, you have in the year 5 of so-and-so's reign, so-and-so became king over here. Or in the 5th year of so-and-so's reign, so-and-so became king over here. You have that every time. You don't have that with Athaliah. You just have what she did. And she thinks that she has all the heirs to the throne killed. So you've got all of Jehoram's brothers out of the picture. You've got all of Ahaziah's brothers out of the picture. And now you have all of Jehoram's grandchildren out of the picture. Again, as was the case with Ahab and Jezebel, just because Ahab married Jezebel doesn't mean that all of Ahab's sons are Jezebel's sons. Just because Jehoram is married to Athaliah doesn't mean that all of Athaliah's, all of Jehoram's children are Athaliah's children. Or direct grandchildren. Now, I don't know that there were none of them caught up in all of this. But, and in fact, we do know that Joash is one of Athaliah's direct grandsons because she's Ahaziah's son, and we know that Ahaziah was Athaliah's. But, for example, Jehoshua is Jehoram's daughter, Ahaziah's sister. But what exactly her relationship is to Athaliah, I don't know, maybe it's stepmother and stepdaughter instead of now, that might not make a whole lot of difference, but it, I mean, it's important to know. Now, notice what happens. Ahaziah's sister had to save Ahaziah's baby boy from Ahaziah's mother. And I have in my notes, yikes. That's a pretty horrible, awful, wretched situation. Over in 2 Chronicles chapter 22 and verse 11, the parallel account of this, Jehoshua, the daughter of the king, which I think indicates to me that she is Jehoram's daughter, but not necessarily Athaliah's daughter, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from the king's sons who were about to be put to death, and she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Thus Jehoshaphat, the daughter of Pethor, and the wife of Joab, the priest, because she was the sister of Ahaziah, hid him from Athaliah, so that she did not put him to death. Athaliah thinks that she has all the heirs to the throne killed and assumed power. Now think about the promise that God had made to David. The promise that God had made to David was that his throne would last forever. There would always be a seed of David to reign. God's promise of an eternal kingdom depends on this one-year-old baby and the work of Jehoshaphat in preserving his life. And while it might appear that the promise is on thin ice, the fact that it's on ice at all shows that God's is providentially looking out. And you know, this is not something that there's some miracle that happens here that Joash is taking care of. It's the effort of Jehoshua that happens. God's not napping, right? Athaliah is taking the throne. She's a wicked, awful woman. God knows what happens. And he preserves a royal seed. He has his servant, Jehoshua, in the right place at the right time, and the promise for the eternal kingdom of David is kept alive, even if it's just barely from our perspective. I don't think it's ever in doubt from God's perspective. But somebody looks at this and says, you mean God's going to pin all the hopes on one day? No, he's pinning all the hopes on his faithfulness. And one day he illustrates that even when it's down to the very, very last, God can preserve his promise. What can one baby do against such a tyrant, Athaliah? Maybe not much, but God can do a great deal. And so Athaliah rules for 6 years, never discovering that one of her grandsons escapes. Now, just saying that sentence out loud is disturbing, right? That if she could have found that he had escaped and knew where he was, we know what she would have done because of the kind of woman that she was. And so God providing for him was by hiding him for those 6 years. Now Jehoiada, the priest, is also Jehoshaphat's husband. And when he's seven, the seventh year, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of the Karaites and of the guard and had them come to him in the house of the Karaites were a foreign military unit that served as the bodyguards for the king. And one of the reasons that they did that was because if they were locals, if they were natives, then they would be tied into all of the political maneuvering in the country. So they got foreigners to come in so that they wouldn't be swayed by local uprisings in order to be a bodyguard of the king. They were like the secret service of ancient Judah. And in 2 Chronicles 23, we learn there that the Karaites, the officers are named who Jehoiada entrusted with this information, and they gather the Levites, and they gather the heads of the families, and they bring them to Jerusalem. Now, apparently, Athaliah has little to no religious or military support. The religious leaders, like Jehoiada, the high priest, they're not on Athaliah's side. And the military leaders, at least these Karaites, look like they are perfectly willing to go along with Jehoiada's plan because she has no support. And so what they do is they arrange a time when there's going to be a changing of the guard on the Sabbath day. And the reason that's significant is because when they change out the guard, now there's a double amount of forces on the ground. Right? Normally there's just one unit, but at the changing of the guard, there's two for a period of time. And so they arrange for this coup, this overthrow of the throne to take place on that day. Now here's what's happening out there. There's some difficulty in some of the translation here. I'm not going to tell you what I don't think it's saying. I'm going to tell you what I do think it's saying. One company of Karaites was going to guard the palace. It was the company that was normally on duty on the Sabbath is going to be responsible for guarding the palace. A second company was going to stand guard at the gate of Sur, which we don't know where that is, but anyway, they're going to stand guard. The third company was going to stand guard at the palace and at the city entrance so that if the palace guard needs help, they would come in and aid them. And then there were two platoons who were going to stand guard, and the king, Joash, is going to be in the temple, and those two platoons are going to be there to protect Notice verse 12. They brought the king's son. He's referred to as the king's son to make sure we understand he's being tied into this Davidic line. This is not just some random. This is the king's son. All this is happening to him. Puts the crown on him, the Davidic crown. Gives him the testimony. The testimony here is the copy of the law. Do you remember that the king was to make his own copy for the law? That's what Jehoiada is entrusting to Joash. So you've got the Davidic crown, you've got the Mosaic law, and they proclaimed the king and anointed it, and they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king." And so what you have now is you've got to commit to the Davidic dynasty with the crown, you've got a commitment to the Mosaic covenant with the testimony being handed over, and you've got a commitment to the people. And what's happening here with the anointing and the coronation of Jehoash is we're rolling the clock back. We're going back before Ahab has influenced Judah. And we're going back to the way it should have been in the beginning with David and Moses and the people. Okay. Now, Athaliah hears the noise, goes to see what's going on. She sees this boy king with all the signs of authority, with all the signs of the office. He's got a crown on his head and a law in his hand. And she yells, "Treason." You see the irony of that? That's the pot calling the kettle black, you might say. She says, "Treason, treason." She knows her time is up, I think. Jehoiada says, "Bring her out, put her to death, and anybody who follows her. And don't kill her in the house of the Lord." So they take her to the horse's entrance to the king's house. And there she was put there. That's the exact opposite of the house of the Lord. The horse's entrance, I guess, as far on the other end of the spectrum you can get. And so David's one remaining descendant is on the throne. The northern style usurper is removed. And it seems possible for the first time in a long time that God's purposes might be on the agenda of the king too. Because he has this good influence in Jehoiada working with him. That's all the time we have for tonight. We'll pick up there, Lord willing, on Sunday. Thank you very much. I know we are trying to cover a lot, but it's material that maybe is not the most familiar to us, but it's so important and I think helps build our faith.